Hey everyone, welcome back to the Viral Volley Podcast, and it's our final special segment featuring Olympic head coach and Santa Clara Beach coach, as well as Court 2 commentator for the AVP Champions Cup Series, Jeff Alzina. Kind of a lot of rising stars this last weekend, or last 3 weeks, and definitely Coach Alzina is one of them, as you heard his voice on the Court 2 stream on Amazon Prime. So, hey Jeff, thanks for joining us for our final, kind of sad thing at the final recap of the AVP Champions Cup Series. But let's first talk about the Porsche Cup, which is the final cup tournament for all of our AVP athletes. Let's start with the qualifiers. First coming out as a Q1 were Tracy Callahan and Chrissy Jones. The Q6 qualifier, Sheila Shaw and Kenzie Ponnet on the women's side. On the men's side, you had Billy Allen and Stafford Slick as a Q1. And Miles Evans, Ricardo Santos, the Q3. Any shockers there for you, Jeff?
Not really a shock. I mean, those qualifiers were really, really tough. So I can't, you know, I almost want to say that almost anyone could have come out of there because there's a ton of talent on both the men's and the women's side. I mean, when you have a number 6 seed out of 12 coming in, it seems like it could be a shock, but they're all really good players. And a little bit of it was the draw. A little bit of it was maybe who had played with their partner before and who got the most amount of training. There was so many like smaller X factors that typically don't come in to play on a qualifier situation like this because of trying to partner up a little bit at the last minute and then being able to practice with your partner enough. You got to be in the right same town. You got to be able to go to a beach that's open. And then you got to have a certain amount of chemistry before you show up.
Now, there were some great players that came out of there that had some new partnerships that formed. Obviously, Tracy Callahan and Chrissy Jones was one of them. But the other ones, did any of the newer partnerships stick out in your mind? And did you think they were going to do a little better than that?
I think with Reed and David Lee, those are two super elite athletes and really good individual players. And they obviously have chemistry from the indoor court together. I'm not sure what transpired with them not being able to break through and get into the men's draw. I would think that a harder packed surface that we had would favor them. I would also, it's bringing blocking into play a lot, and it's going to, you know, allow them both to bring their full physicality in the side out game. And there wasn't any wind really. It's usually pretty still. It was definitely a jumper's beach and didn't really put a premium on ball control. So I don't know, like I'm surprised that they didn't really get in there, but I don't know what kind of training they were allowed to do or able to do together before they got in there. But that's obviously a super talented team that didn't make it. But you know, you got guys like Miles Partain and, you know, playing with Ty Loomis. That's just a great mix. Miles is really, really good and young. And so him being able to pick up an older partner helped a ton. Miles Evans, also relatively inexperienced on the big stage from an experience standpoint. And, playing with Ricardo, huge. It's going to be really hard to knock Ricardo out of the qualifier.
Yeah.
Get Ed Ratledge in there with Del Sol. They were really, really good. There's a lot of tough teams on the men's side and the women's too. Women's was stacked.
Well, that
I'm only surprised probably that Zana Muno and Amanda Dowdy didn't come out. And I know they were really close in that third set against, I think it was Fendrick and Day who knocked them out in the second event. But yeah, stacked talent.
Well, you know, obviously it wasn't streamed, so a lot of people didn't get to see what was going on there in Long Beach during the qualifier Friday, but it was David Lee and Reed Pretty against Miles Evans and Ricardo Santos. And in the third set, Reed had to take a medical timeout. And because we were going from an Instagram feed, no one could really tell what was going on. But you can hear the chatter alongside. And you can hear, I think he's cramping. I think he cramped. I think he's cramping. Because I guess it was like 80 degrees in the morning on Friday morning. So it could have been upwards of around 90, 95 out there at the convention center. So what happened was, Reed and Lee took their timeout, their medical timeout, 5 minutes. As soon as they got back on the court, they took their team timeout. So, it could have been a different result because they're going in a third set tiebreak and they ended up losing 2-1 to Ricardo and Miles. So it could have been a totally different main draw that Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, with only 8 teams in the total main draw, I mean, you know, that's a third of a normal tournament often, you know. There's usually at least 24 teams and sometimes even 32 teams in these draws. So all those qualifier teams are, you know, you can't really knock them for not making it. I mean, those are just tough normal second or third round draws for a lot of teams. So, and really hard experience at the highest level with 3 Olympic medals. So,
yeah. Well, let's jump over into Survival Saturday, or day one of the Porsche Cup, which we knew there was going to be some good stuff happening during the Porsche Cup, because one of the highlights was the guarantee that Trevor Crabb made on his Instagram post. But I didn't tell you I was going to share the image with you here. I don't know if you got a chance to see it in the on your Instagram feed, but I've got it up here. Hold on 1 second. Let's put it up for our viewers. Sorry for our people on the podcast, but oops, I got my Snapchat filter, my Jeff Alzina Snapchat filter up. That was such
a trend, awesome, man. From James Harden to the McKibbins, now me and now Rob. I mean, dude, look at you.
Oops, my bad. I didn't mean to plan that at all.
You're still Hollywood.
There you go. There's Trevor Crabb's Instagram post. I had to kind of put it family-friendly here. More pressure, yeah. I guarantee, censored T, a W. huge statement, but I am looking back now, he was spot on.
I think it was really smart. I mean, what do you got to lose? You know, he's been right there knocking on the door for a really long time. He believes in he and his partner, Tri, you know, who have only been able to play a limited amount of events together, with Tri coming back after the autoimmune disease. And I don't know. I mean, you have to believe that you can win. And when I say believe, like, everyone might say, well, I believe I can win a tournament, or I can believe this. But, like, there's levels of that belief. Right. Like, you have to believe that you can do it now, that you're actually prepared, that you've been through enough. And, you know, I think it's good to have those kind of statements. To me, his guarantee is really just a form of saying, I know I can do it. Right. And making that statement, sometimes you might say it to your coach, you might say it to your significant other, you might say it to your partner. Going out and saying it to the world is pretty bold. But to me, I didn't see it as being something super extravagant, to be honest. You know, they were really, really close. They'd been, like, literally blowing out other teams on the way to get to Phil and Nick, or Jake and Taylor. And so, you know, for him, it was really either one big win or two big wins that they've been close on. And so I think it's a really positive thing to just commit and send it out to the universe. Like, I'm ready. I'm ready to win this match. That's the kind of fire that they need. They bring it all out and go for it.
Well, you know, it's funny because the theme, definitely a theme, but definitely the atmosphere was set nice and early, because in my notes I had it called, is it the AVP Champions Cup or the AVP Chatter Cup? Because Trevor was definitely stoking that fire, and Casey Patterson was stepping in, but it made for some great entertainment, hot mics on the court, no doubt.
Oh, absolutely. It's created tons more dialogue for them. I mean, there's a couple things coming at the same time. I mean, there's a guarantee from one of the biggest trash talkers on tour saying he's going to win, which is great, which brings out a lot of fire on social media, brings out fire on the court. And then thirdly, I think there was also just a situation where the players got used to not having fans, and the players that typically love fans, you know, try and bring something extra into their game by talking to fans. They figured out at this third event, like, I'm just going to have to do it on my own. I'm going to have to either talk something to the ref, or I'm going to talk under the net, or I'm going to fire my partner up. Trevor did all three. And I think, you know, there's definitely a handful of players that play better when they're that emotionally engaged. You know, you don't have to be a jerk. You don't have to be out of control emotionally, but you just have to be totally engaged so that your mind is fresh on every single play. And there's a million different ways to do it, but that one worked for him.
Well, you know, there is
a... thinking about it. In the old days, think about how many guys would have done stuff like that. I mean, in the 80s and the 90s, in old school volleyball, there was tons of trash talk constantly. You know, we went through about a decade where we didn't have any, you know, from maybe 2004 to 2014. And then Trevor came out and helped bring it back with Casey Patterson and a few others.
Yeah, well, I saw the comment, sand throwing fools. He was referring to a certain group of guys on the beach. Oh, yeah. Hi, Loomis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's awesome. I love it. I think there's tons of room for that on that tour.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hey, so one of the things that was, I felt was not, I don't want to say common, but we saw a lot more of were some potentially not accurate calls. I mean, I know hashtag refs are people too, but there were some missed calls, non-calls, and you know, in match number one of the day, it was Santos Evans against Nick and Phil. There were a couple of missed calls, but I mean, the one that really grabbed the attention was match number three of the day, which is Hayden Casebeer against Bourne and, of course, Trevor Crabb. Open hand tip by Trevor Crabb, which gave them a set point after trailing most of the first set to Hayden.
22-21, right?
Yep. Yeah. It made it 22-21, reversing the set point. We saw the replay, but I mean, as far as like officiating and timing and how that can, what that can do to momentum for athletes on the court.
Well, you know, no one ever came out and said anything officially about whether the referees were trying to keep it a little loose due to the fact that some of the players obviously have not trained in the manner that they're used to training. I mean, let's be honest, right? These guys usually start, if they take off November and December, if they're lucky enough to, they are out there training full time in January, February, March, April. I mean, so you come to July, you know, they're in the seventh month. They're at the absolute peak of form. And, you know, nobody was able to be in peak form. They played really well. I mean, everyone I think was surprised, even the players, the refs, the coaches were all like, wow, people are actually playing at a quite high level. So I don't know. I think there was a situation where maybe they were trying to back off of some of the double calls going on, but stuff like that. I mean, the refs got to get those straight. They got, you know, the R2 is down there looking at the net and the refs watching the ball be played, and Trevor chucked the crap out of that thing.
Well, you know, there were, I believe it was during the, was it the qualifiers that there were no lines officials? They're just R1, R2. Was that the case? I didn't even notice on Saturday for Survival Saturday. Were there lines officials as well?
No, that's the next thing I wanted to mention. They didn't have lines judges on Saturday.
Okay.
At the Porsche Cup, and to be totally honest, I talked to Maddie Bishop, my co-commentator, and we said, wait a minute, there's no line judges right now. Do you remember it last week? I don't remember if there was in the second event, the Wilson Cup or not. But at the Porsche Cup, no. And the official word that came back to us was just you can't have – when the full allotment of teams were on site, there was literally like a number that you could have on site. And so they said, hey, we can't have line judges for that. So that definitely made some of the ball mark calls difficult and touches really, really difficult. But, you know, to me, you should still be able to get all the net play stuff wired pretty well. Right. But no line judges and the way that that ball's traveling that fast, it's pretty tough.
Oh, yeah, especially that level of play, you know. We already talked about Bourne and Trevor Crabb. They basically steamrolled everyone. They were 2-0 all of Saturday. But let's go to some of the women's side of the tournament there. Upset of the day caught my eye. Kelly Kalinske, Emily Stockman, taking the number 3 seed, Sarah Hughes and Brandi Wilkerson. Any thoughts on that particular matchup and your thoughts as to what happened?
Yeah, that was the morning game on Sunday, yeah?
No, this is still on Saturday.
Excuse me, Saturday. Yes. Kalinske versus, yeah, that's right. That was the 11-20 game. They just played lights out. They just absolutely played lights out. I've seen those two train a lot, Kalinske and Stockman, when I was living in LA the last several years before I moved up north for the Santa Clara job. They used to train on the court right next to me, and they trained their tails off. I mean, they work really hard. They go many days a week and they play super physical ball, but I hadn't seen them bring it like that in a match for a while. And my commentary in the first two events was that they look really good, but when the games got tight and especially after 18 in transition, it was all shots. And they'd often just kind of like make up an easy shot when, even if they had an open net. And that's what totally changed in that morning match. They just basically, it was Stockman. She had 20 digs in that match, outdug Sarah Hughes, and was utterly terminal in transition. She was just going up and banging like she absolutely can and should, especially on that surface. So, you know, I mean, perfectly flat sand, no wind. You get a high ball, they should be going up and cracking, and she did. Yeah. It was probably one of their signature wins as a team.
Well, you definitely, you've mentioned it's a jumper's court. So she hit 513. 22 kills, and I mean, that was the difference maker. Kelly tacked on 2 blocks and 7 control blocks, but I mean, that they're 5-13 against one of the best blockers in the world in Brandi Wilkerson.
Yeah, you know, they made it look like she wasn't there for, you know, about half an hour. They just Stockman digs a good ball, and she's really rangy. She can go super sharp down the right side of the court, but her specialty is just boatloads of range to her left from the right side of the court. Anything that's cross body towards that sideline, she hits it high, hard, and sharp. You know, and I was comparing her to, in some ways to Jake. How, like, if you've got a fast line shot and then you've got the deep angle and then you can break off that sharp angle, like, it's really hard to stop you. Yeah. And Klinsky set her really, really well. High balls in transition, and Stockman was aggressive.
Let's jump over to another women's matchup, another upset. Number 8, Kenzie Ponit, Sheila Shaw, upsetting number 5, Emily Day, and Lauren Fendrick. And it was in the contenders bracket elimination match. You know, we talked a little bit earlier, but statistically, every category was close, and it came down to service errors. You know, but Ponit and Shaw actually got better as the weekends went on. So it made – I don't think that was much of an upset because they were going to find their groove, especially after Hermosa Beach last year. Any thoughts on that?
Ponit was gnarly. At the end of that game, I think she was the number – she had the highest hitting percentage in the Porsche Cup. Oh. Kenzie Ponit was like 482, I believe, and was number one just in that phase after those two matches she played, after her morning match and then that knockout of Day and Fendrick. She was awesome. We called that match, and Sheila played really, really well too. She played to her strength, which is dropping. Sheila's not like known for like being a gnarly big presser at the net, even for 6'1", but she's very cagey and smart on her reads and dropping. And they just kept shooting the ball at her when she dropped. And, you know, we were kind of losing our minds on the mic, just going, man, if they would just hit something at her, it'd be different. But they shot towards her, or Ponit was all over the cross-court digs. And Ponit was just legit. She was legit from the right and on the left. She flip-flopped a few different times when she was siding out, ran some back sets in different areas. And I was really impressed by her. I very, very impressed by her offense and her poise.
Yeah.
She never got rattled. She never felt like the match was bigger than her or the moment was bigger than her. And she just kind of kept grinding away against two really good veterans and took it to them.
Yeah, she hit 429, 14 kills, and 16 digs. Looks like towards the end there, they were serving Sheila a lot more, but she ended up getting 22 kills, hitting 500. So,
yeah,
good on that that matchup there. That was a fun one to watch, but I thought Dane Fendrick had it locked up, and they got Shaw and Ponit just got better as the match went on.
Oh, yeah. The first set looked like a blowout. It was 21 to 16, I think, or 15. Yeah. Yeah. But the rest of the match was theirs. I mean, Sheila and McKenzie are really good on offense. They're both very good offensive players. There's, like, no real, like, arguing that. The question was just, could Sheila be able to affect them enough up at the net? You know, you're going against Emily Day and Lauren, 2 6-foot-2 big attackers with tons of experience. And, you know, right. She was just able to like stay when she needed to and pull when she needed to. And if she pulled, she converted most of the time. So I was very impressed with him.
Well, let's shift over to Championship Sunday. Start off the morning with some elimination matches. Stafford Slick, Billy Allen against Chase Buttinger and Kame Schalk. Another 3-set tiebreak match. Another call, controversial call in the third. But it ended up going Buttinger and Schalk's way. Kame was called on a double off a hard-driven ball. I think everyone commented, whoa, what was that call for? It looked like, I mean, he was close to the net. The ball was hit hard. His hands are broken, but it popped up, and they called a double on him.
Yeah. But
luckily, it didn't shift the momentum back to Allen and Slick's way.
Yeah. Yeah. There was definitely some very loose setting for a while. The bar got lowered quite a bit. We called that game. It was first game in the morning, and Stafford was just using his hands all over the place, and he ran way off the court on a ball that looked like he was barely going to be able to bump, and instead he like got down halfway into a crouch and hand set it like 25 feet behind him, and the other guys just stopped like, what in the world is going on right now? But Maddie made a great point. He said, like, you know, Chase is obviously a fairly well-regarded blocker. He's got a physical presence. How come he never comes out and dominates matches? And, you know, we started going into it a little bit, and then sure enough, he started that game with, I think, 4 stuff blocks and several controlled blocks, and looked really, really good, but then faded away into that second set. Billy and Stafford just tore him apart, I think 21-11, before that third set got really tight again. But third set could have gone either way.
Let's jump over to one of the women's matches that really caught my eye. the Clay's sponsor against Pavan Humana Paredes. I believe you guys made the call, or I don't know if Maddie was on.
That was the semifinal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Incredibly entertaining match. But would you have called that against the world champs?
I don't think anyone in the world would have called that. There's no way. Not in that style, at least. I mean, Humana Paredes had just been number one in digging across the board, and everybody, that she was one of the real stories of the entire series, was how well she had been digging and you know, pretty well converting too. She, I think she had had a 45% overall side out rating, and Sponsor was a 39. And so I had alluded to, like, you know, Sponsor was somewhere lower in the digs too. I think I got it right here before the match started. Here we go. Sponsor was number 17 out of 18 in hitting percentage going into that. She was at 269, and she was at number six on the dig list at six and a half. And so, you know, Mel was number one all the way. It was totally out hitting her. She was number 11 in swings, 45% kill ratio. So it was kind of like, you know, you would never have called. I didn't even think you could have called them winning, Sponsor and Clay's. But, you know, they've been really, really hot and cold. Yeah. The entire time they've been playing together. And at times they've wrecked some people, but it was really surprising to see the wrecking going on to a top three team in the world.
Well, 6-5 blocker, and get this, Sponsor, 10 kills, zero errors.
It's usually very low error. That part doesn't surprise me, but she was getting kills. When she decides to be a little, like 10% more aggressive and go for a little bit, it helps a lot. But she went out and just read Melissa. We had mentioned, I think after 10 plays across the net, nothing had touched the ground. Even if they had got a kill, the Canadians, it had been touched, either soft block or laid out and touched. So they were just all over her really, really early. And they varied their defenses nicely. And when they got digs, the biggest thing to me was that they took their time. They didn't do the fancy trying to like jack balls over on one and dump stuff until it was way, way late in the second set. And they had, you know, a huge lead to play with, that where they could take some more chances.
Yeah.
So they came out and just played more like just sturdy, solid, high percentage volleyball to get that whole first set. And then most of the way through the second, they did as well. And then all of a sudden, you know, Sponsor was just digging balls so easily that she threw a few over on one or put it up on two. And yeah, they hit on all cylinders, and Melissa and Sarah could not do anything.
Well, after their match, Misty May got called into, or Misty May Trainer got called into the hot seat to do the post-match interview of them, but she's able to comment on their style of play. I'm curious to get your take on it, being that you coached Misty, we'll just say a couple of years ago, just so we don't put any age on you. But she said that that she analyzed, said it was the smoothest play that Team Slays had played on defense, and Kelly did a good job of keeping her head in the game. Now, the mental component has been something for younger players that takes time to develop. Can you comment on how the maturity process pulled them through here?
Yeah, I mean, we've got the ABP and American volleyball has had players that take, I don't know if you want to say it takes a long time to get elite, but they stick around for a long time when they become elite. And it usually does, you know. I mean, even in the 90s, the guys that were coming out of college, there wasn't a big women's side then, but the guys coming out of college, the really elite players were still taking a couple of years to get their first win. And, you know, that was without a whole lot of support, you know, like not being able to play collegiate beach and not a million tournaments for the youth back then. But the women's side, they're going to be thrown into this spotlight a lot faster because they can play all through juniors. They can play all through college full time. And so we're going to have, you know, every year that goes by, we're going to start getting some 20, 21, 22, 23 year old players that can knock on the door of being the best in the United States. Mm-hmm. So yes, she, both of them are very, very young, but they've also had a lot of really elite coaching already. So I think the X's and O's are there for them, but it's, you always struggle when you're younger with just flat out decision-making. Right. I mean, they've got all the talent in the world. I think I said a week ago, like, you know, they're as talented as Kerry and Misty were when they came out of college in the early 2000s. Skill for skill, they're equally or more talented. Right. I mean, Kerry and Misty never really handset. They never really jump served. They weren't running a very, dynamic offense, if you will. It was just bump setting straight up and down. So skill for skill, Sponsor and Clay's, to me, are honestly beyond them. But what Carrie and Misty had was a certain level of patience and maturity and just true IQ on what works and what percentages are. Mm-hmm. And Sarah and Kelly both can definitely, you know, they've shown over the past year and a half, they can really get ahead of themselves, you know, because of a lot of crazy elite talent that they have. They see things earlier than other players might, and they have the talent to do some different things that other players might not do on the first or second contact.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean you should. It doesn't mean you should. You know, there's still a lot of value for both of them in passing that ball high enough that you can go on to, but then setting that ball really, really well, because they're both super elite hand setters and they have choices on where to set the ball all along the net. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was really harsh on them at the Wilson Cup because they had tried so many of these goofy plays and really low percentage stuff right in crucial times in a match. Mm-hmm. And basically since then, I don't know if they listened or someone told them, or if, you know, maybe just their coach Jordan said, hey, it's time to like play some higher percentage ball, but they really, really did in their next matches at Wilson and then all throughout this Porsche Cup. So I'm not surprised that if they play that kind of volleyball, that's the kind of success they'll have.
Well, they must have listened to you, or someone did, because Sarah in that post-match interview actually said they felt they were trying to be overly creative when they were trying to play in their matches. And that's what was getting them out of rhythm and out of, in a funk. So, yeah.
Right.
But throwing
that a lot in effect, offensively and defensively.
Yeah. She also added that losing to Sarah and Melissa was kind of a tough pill to swallow these last two weekends as well. So that's great information in itself.
Right. No, they have just a boatload of skill. And when they can package it properly and know when to use that and keep it literally at high percentage, I mean, their coach Jordan Chang is a big stats guy. So you want it, when you've got so much elite offense and so many choices to your offense, each category needs to be broken down, right? For each skill. When we run a shoot set on the right, when we run a shoot set on a bad pass, when we run shoot sets after 15, when we run shoot sets when we're trailing at the end of a match or in the third set, they should all be broken down situationally, because I would not be surprised at all to find out if there was some gross discrepancy in how successful trick plays are at different times of the game.
Well, let's move on to the final lists. Now, we saw a matchup on the women's side of course, Kelly Clay, Sarah Sponsel against number one seed April and Alex for the A team. Obviously, everyone is expecting April and Alex will be there, but did you think they're going to win it as authoritatively as they did these last three weekends and also as powerfully as they did during the Porsche Cup?
I didn't give much thought to like how they would win. I thought they would win, but I thought the Canadians would challenge them a little more, to be honest, Melissa and Sarah. Mm-hmm. In that final, I thought Clays and Sponsel played really well again in that final. I mean, they played a lot higher percentage volleyball. They were really smart. They were creative, but to an extent, and they didn't really force the issue. And Kelly is really, really terminal on too, especially when she hits it and when she hits it cross body. But April and Alex, like, I don't even know. Alex is too big. She's too big. You just can't do much against her. You know, Sarah's big too, but it just feels like Alex is contacting the ball at an even higher point than Pavin. Alex just looks really, really hard to stop. And so when you get the ball off of her and then you're serving April Ross, April's huge too. She's 6'1" and she's really strong and hits a heavy ball and hits sharp balls and hits with a lot of range. And Alex is a tremendous setter, like a really, really good bump setter. So their side out game is just kind of ridiculous. You know, like their side out game is just off the charts. I don't know who you serve. I don't know how you serve to try to break them down and score four. You probably need four or five real points. You need set to 21 to have a chance to win. If you're only going to score three, then that means you have to side out better than all but three.
Yeah.
And siding out against them is just brutal too. I mean, Alex is getting better and better as a blocker. She's certainly getting better as a puller. She's getting a lot more comfortable when she can pull off the net in situations. And when she does that, forget it. You got 6'5 and 6'1 covering the belly of the court, you know, and they're both going to crush it in transition. So.
Well, what I noticed in Alex particularly during the series is I believe her reactionary time has gotten better off the block, because with Kelly optioning over on two, Alex was able to react quickly enough to at least get a good touch on it for a playable ball for April. So, and she did that, like they came prepared to play Kelly and Sarah. So, you know, props to Alex for developing that over this last, I guess, season, off season, whatever you want to call it. So,
Right.
Extended preseason. Yeah. So let's move on.
Yeah, I mean, that's where she should really be putting a lot of her energy into that. I mean, she's our, you know, I hate to say good enough. It's not like you don't train something, but you prioritize your training and you prioritize your skills. And, you know, when you're 95, 96, 97% good enough at something, you're really firing on the majority of the cylinders you can on a skill. It's time to like look at the ones that you really think you can improve on by 10 or 15 or 20%, you know, and the broken play, ball handling, dropping, things like that for her are huge. You know, when she starts doing those and making those two or three extra plays the way that Kerry Walsh used to do on broken plays, that's when it's just kind of lights out.
Yeah. Well, let's shift over to the men's side and, you know, kind of a shocker final because we just kind of thought it would have been Jake and Taylor and Nick and Phil, but, you know, the guaranteeing the victory, you instead had another crab brother in there with Tri Bourne taking on Nick and Phil, but I thought Nick and Phil were so good this entire series. I'm like, oh, there's no way they're going to get unseated. What are your thoughts on the guys? I know that Tri and Trevor are your guys, and you've been seemingly like, oh, I just really want these guys to win, and they did it. And it's got to be exciting to see how they did it.
It is. They've wanted it so bad, and they've worked their tail off. They've done everything that you can do, right? I mean, they've done all of the training that you can possibly train on it. They've covered every base. They're another team that's a lot like a Sponsal and Clay's. They have a tremendous amount of options on what they can do. They can switch sides if they want. They can split block if they want. They both have tremendous hand setting abilities, so they can run a very complex advanced offense. They can run quicks and shoots and inside and outside. So, you know, again, they have all the skills too. And for them, it was a matter of like, can you put it together, not just more consistently, but against really just the top two teams in America right now? Because they've clearly been able to do it against everyone else and do it well. So, I don't know. I mean, they came out in that first set. They looked pretty, Trevor and Tri looked really, really good and clean. They looked hungrier, like they were ready, like, the, you know, the guarantee was on. There was a lot of chatter under the net talking about in or out and talking smack to Nick about his hitting. And I think that really worked for them. When you can, I don't know, I think it put Phil and Nick in a little bit of, like, defensive mode. And it made them maybe, maybe their minds were going somewhere else during certain plays about a bigger picture of what if, like, these guys are so crazy, you know? So, I mean, they were a distraction and it worked in that first set, but sure enough, Phil and Nick came back in the second and really just kind of buried them. Yeah. Just took care of them. Phil made the adjustments necessary on Tri and really shut him down in the second. But in the third, I have to give a lot of credit to Trevor and Tri, but Phil and Nick just did not look good in that third set. It was literally the only set that I've seen them play poorly, I thought, in that third set. They still were in there. It was 11-11, I think, and it was close. But, you know, Nick had two kind of uncharacteristic passing errors, really just shanked it. Phil had a chuck on a fairly simple ball. He never has a throw in the third set in his life. Yeah. You know, and then he admitted that he was – you know, not setting Nick very well. And once I kind of paid a little closer attention to that, when Phil had admitted it himself, you could really tell he was not giving Nick the ball he's used to. Yeah. He'd miss him inside, and the very next play, Phil would miss him outside, overcorrecting. You know, and if it was a joust on a play, the next set, instead of 4 feet off, would be 7 feet off. And, you know, still credit to Tri and Trevor all the way, but Phil was in a little bit of a funk, which is kind of rare with the precision that we're used to seeing him set.
Yeah. Well, so seeing them come play as well as they did this entire series was amazing because with that, they got the gold bonus money, $50K. Nice. And then you had Jake and Taylor with 25 and then sneaking in right there, your boys, Trevor and Tri with, I believe it's 10K. So on the women's side, it was April and Alex with that 50K. And then is it Sarah and Melissa with the 25 with the silver? Bonus
silver,
and then
yeah.
Bronze sneak it in there in that third spot, Brandy and Sarah. So they sneak out with a 10K.
I don't know if it was mentioned on NBC because I didn't want to have the volume up the whole time while I was watching. But if Sponsal and Clay's had won, they could have stolen that bronze race to the cup, the bonus pool.
Yeah. Wise waiting for something to show up, but no one made a statement until a good time after a play had completed. So it's like, maybe they're doing some intense calculations here. Maybe it was that close, you know? So, but we do need to mention 100th career victory for Phil Dellhauser occurred this last weekend. So, I mean, incredible accomplishment, you know, for Phil.
Super legit, you know, especially playing through situations like this, like COVID, when there's hardly any tournaments, through the changing of the guard with the tour, you know, the Corvo Tour only provided a few events in 2011, 2012, when the AVP went under after the Nivea deal and all that. And, you know, and then Donald brought it back, but he brought it back slowly and measuredly, as he should. And so it was like a year where there was 4 events, and then it was 5, then it was 6 for a while. So to get 100 wins in your career and be that healthy for that long and be that dominant, it's amazing. Phil is really something super, super special.
Yeah.
That we've been fortunate to watch our, you know, the last 15, 20 years.
If they could just keep that kind of momentum going into 2021 Tokyo, you know, it's going to be hard to stop if they're fresh. They look so good this entire last 3 weeks. So
I just really want to say, if you guys are listening, Phil and Nick, keep it going. Don't mess around. Do whatever it takes to get that momentum. Because when you guys played in that fresh way that you played for these last 3 weeks, you guys look pretty darn unstoppable 99% of the time. So keep bringing it.
Yeah.
If they're going to be there and they're going to represent us, it's medal time. No more fifth places, boys.
Well, looking at this last 3 weekends of events, what did we learn? What do you feel are the top 3 takeaways on both the men's and women's side for beach volleyball and the AVP?
Well, the first takeaway that's top of my head is just that our top 3 men's teams look phenomenal. They look really good. Trevor, the 3 that are going for the Olympic Games, Jake and Taylor, Trevor Try, and Phil and Nick, they all look like they could medal when they're playing near the top of their game. Mm-hmm. So that's really encouraging. I hope that we get a chance to see them really battle it out properly and fairly sometime next year, and that our best 2 teams that are also our kind of hottest teams are going to be representing us in Tokyo. Phil and Nick, just like I said, they look so good and so refreshed and so, like, they looked relaxed and cool, but they also looked like focused, like they really wanted to win points and matches throughout, you know. And I know that the talk has been that they've struggled with motivation the last couple of years, but, you know, I don't know if that's true or not, but there's no room for that if you really want to go medal in the Olympic Games. And if they bring it like they did this last 3 weeks, they will. Mm-hmm. Jake and Taylor looked really, really good at times, like really fluid. They also went through some sputters on offense, but either Jake or Taylor, I'm sure we need to shore a few things up offensively, but defensively and chemistry wise they look really great. And obviously Try and Trevor needed to answer some of those questions on their defense, and I hope they found some statistical evidence and got some psychological evidence that can push them over the top as a defensive team to match their awesome offense.
Well, I think on the women's side, April and Alex are definitely a lock in that number one spot. I mean, they just look so efficient and they look so powerful and they look so in control. So you know, but beyond that, what does it look like from a USA standpoint for international competition in the Olympics, being that, you know, if you think about it, 3 of the top, like, we'll say 10 players are Canadians in so
on the
who steps up?
Right. Well, I don't know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in this offseason, right? There's the Netherlands is going to host that event in September in about 6 weeks. Is it a King of the Court format? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Utrecht, the Netherlands.
That's all that they really have going forward at some of those top teams. There's some talk about USA Volleyball, the beach department, putting something together like training camps where the top guys and gals can train against each other, maybe even putting together a smaller competition amongst themselves through this fall, something to keep them fresh. And maybe even doing training blocks, right? Like 3 weeks on, a week or so off, 3 weeks on, off too. So they're still getting rest, but they ultimately want to stay pretty sharp too for the opportunity when it does arise to go play in an event. But I think, you know, most of the players will try and rest again for the most part. I hope they train with their coaches and do a ton of video work. There's so much that you can glean from quality statistical analysis these days. And, you know, every match they've got on video somewhere. someplace.
They just need someone who's got the ability to break it down, though. I mean, with the experience and how to really process those numbers and how to apply that from a practical standpoint. So, and that's where you come in. Sorry, I'm not promoting your future career.
I learned a lot more when I went and got my master's degree, you know, like I knew some basic statistical information, some basic learning methodologies and things. But I think that every coach should go take motor learning courses and not just a seminar or something, but really go study some motor learning, because it's amazing how it can change the way that you choose what to train on and how you prioritize what you want to train. So there's a lot of stuff out there during this downtime that can make our elite athletes even better, even if they're not working out.
I wanted to go to another question, because there were some teams that had some high expectations, both the men's and the women's side. You know, Reed Pretty, David Lee, Tim Bobber, and Troy Field, the team of Therese Cannon, Kelly Reeves, Amanda Dowdy-Larson, and Zana Muno. I thought they would have advanced out of at least one of the qualifiers and into the main draw, but obviously the shorter format, they didn't get to play a whole bunch of time together. What is the potential of some of these teams that if they were able to train longer?
I think all the teams you mentioned have a ton of talent, and the teams that came out of the qualifier to beat them have a ton of talent too. It's our game takes a long time to master, if you will, the skills. But sometimes you don't have to have them all mastered before you become truly elite. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can be good enough with your skill, but just learn how to win. You have to learn how to win and win big points in big moments. And, you know, when you don't get to compete a ton, it's hard. And I think we have, compared to maybe 15, 20, 25 years ago, we've definitely have created a culture of training and practicing, which is like getting better at skill. You know, there's certainly a lot to be learned and a lot to be gained from going out with your coach as a twosome. And just, you know, getting a million swings from a certain spot, or digs from a certain spot, or transition sets, you know, those kind of blocked learning. But compared to 20 years ago, there's not as much just, I'm going to go compete against you. And I might even go compete all day. In the 90s, you know, guys would really compete for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 hours on a certain day, just in the off season or whenever. And against a lot of different type of player too, you know, like they might, top guys might be playing with just AAA guys, you know, for a couple matches because they were down there and they were available. And you might learn something like how to like pick up guys with a different funky arm, or, you know, funkier set, or a serve that you don't typically see, you know? And so, I don't know. I hope that players can look outside the box a little bit, because especially our Olympic players, when you get there, you know, it's just 6 matches. That's it. There's no qualifiers or anything. When you show up, it's just like, you need 6 to win. And you have to perform on that given day. And so you have to be ready for anything. And so the faster way to get ready for anything sometimes is to train with randomness, right? Not to train in blocks of just, I'm going to be really good at this thing. So I hope that the USA Volleyball can find a way to let these top teams and maybe some other mid-level teams and some of these qualifier teams compete against each other and just learn how to win, learn how to win points. Mm-hmm. And if at all possible, put something on it too.
Well, I definitely want to draw attention to teams that were there every week, at least on the women's side. Tracy Callahan, Chrissy Jones, Emily Day, Lauren Fendrick. You know, they Day and Fendrick, they started as a 6 seed, dropped out, had to qualify, went in as a Q1, and then were the 5th seed again for the Porsche Cup. 3 weekends for them. You know, great show by those teams. Any comments on future of Callahan Jones down the line?
They looked really good together. I mean, the other teams that we had mentioned, often there was at least one super veteran who was qualifying, right? Like Ricardo or Ed Ratledge, mm-hmm. or Emily and Fendrick. But outside of, you know, that veteran experience getting you through those big games, yeah, there's some solid young talent in there and newer type talent as well. I mean, Field, I don't know. He's got to compete a lot more as well. You know, he might be going through a little bit of the Rosie syndrome when Rosie was young, of like, I've got this crazy jump. I can bounce balls. I can do a lot of fun, you know, fancy stuff, but you just got to win points, and you got to win, especially 18 to 21 is the points you got to win. Callahan and Jones look like the type that can do that. They were smart, steady. Like Tracy Callahan is pretty darn legit on the right side of the court. And she's really solid in transition too. She's taller player, stronger player. So again, when she gets balls up, she can score. It's not like a 5'6" defender scooping and not being able to put it away. Right. And then Chrissy Jones, setting is just legit. She's got a really long, long block. She puts it up in a good spot. She doesn't move around too much. Her setting is not only clean, but it's bold and it's really on location. So they both look like they've got a lot of upside to them too.
Yeah, you know, definitely with Chrissy Jones, seeing her go up against Sarah Pavin and Brandi Wilkerson, she was actually holding her own. And yeah, refreshing to see. She's what, considered a second-year player on the tour, if this would have been a second year.
Yeah, exactly. It's shortened to extra year. Yeah, she's really good on the left, and her side-out game looks pretty legit. So I think that, you know, if that's a partnership, they can do some damage. I know that Chrissy's also played with Zana quite a bit. And I don't know, maybe Chrissy was just looking for someone with a little more like tour experience when she picked up Callahan. But Zana has a huge future too. You know, I mean, they took that third in Hermosa after coming out of the qualifier. Yeah. And having worked with Zana a bit at UCLA, she's a really good all around player. She can block, she can dig if she needs to and play that role. She can dead legit play left or right. And she also has kind of the X factor of being a great competitor, of just doing whatever it takes, no excuses, to get points and find ways to win. Yeah. So you got a bright future too.
Well, I definitely want to say thank you to the AVP, Donald Sun, Jeff Conover, Josh Glazebrook. I know there's a few others. Al Lau. I mean, there are a bunch of names that put in a ton of unprecedented effort, because we are dealing with something in our time in history that's never been seen before. And they've had to adapt and make this event happen, even down to having remote commentators in you and Matty Bishop. But phenomenal job. And I couldn't even imagine what it took. But I'm sure Josh Glazebrook, when that last ball dropped, and as soon as that last truck is packed from Long Beach, he's going to like disappear from California and be somewhere else. So, but can you comment?
I don't know. He might be getting a lot of pressure to do it again. I mean, they put that thing together so well. They knocked it out of the park. I mean, just with from a production side, from a sponsor side, from the venue, from the health and safety of the players, every perspective, they knocked it out of the park in a, like you said, in an unprecedented situation. It wasn't something like they could draw on, oh, we've done this before, let's just try this again. You know, they pulled it right out of the rabbit's hat and they killed it. And so I'm sure that there's going to be, you know, a certain amount of clamoring from both fans and players alike to like, you think maybe we can run this again somewhere if it fits?
Well, and they had to deal with a moving standard, because with the way COVID has hit, we've been going, oh, we're locked down again. Oh, do we need to be quarantined? It's no one knew. It's so fluid of a time, yet they were able, I mean, they almost were able to walk on water the way this was pulled. I mean, you look at the other sports, you guys actually alluded to it in one of your streams, but you know, Major League Baseball, they've got some infections going on there. They got some NBA infections. And you know, I know it's a smaller event, but to my knowledge, it's been scot-free so far, which is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. 18 teams, each gender, 36 times two, 72. Yeah. 72 athletes at least. And then maybe some standbys that were all, you know, took it 100% serious and wanted to go see if they can make it. You know, another thing that was cool was you get $1,500. If you were in the qualifier for all three due to points, even for dead lasts, you get $1,500 per player. So they got paid for, you know, basically their service in a way and their ability to create points over the last year, year and a half to qualify for even being in the qualifier. Yeah. ADP just deserves a ton of credit. That was awesome.
Yeah. Well, definitely kudos to all those guys mentioned. If there's some I left out, I apologize, but I know that those are the main names that were constantly being mentioned and who I've worked with in recent years. And I know they're grinders. They were, you know, I'm surprised they probably didn't sleep at all the last probably 2 months. So,
oh yeah. Yeah, seriously.
You know, I wanted to ask you, being that you've been in the game as long as you have been with the experience you have, but we're in unprecedented times. I hate saying it, so you hear it so often, but nothing but large question marks. what's next for all the athletes in this COVID culture? Like, what happens now with an uncertainty of like, will there be events? Will there be more international events? How are we going to keep the competitive edge, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, I alluded to it a little bit earlier after with you, but I talked to a lot of the players throughout the course of those 3 weeks. And I talked to a lot of the coaches, and to be perfectly honest, there was still just question marks. There's nothing. There's nothing telling them you should bank on this. Nothing. I mean, a lot of the players are just taking a break right now. If they're not going to that event in the Netherlands, they're done. They're going to take some time off right now until they hear something different. Because as we all know, everybody knows, if they're working at all right now, or even if they're not working, this waiting game can really grate on your nerves and your psyche. You know, it's just the uncertainty of your life, of your livelihood, of being able to pay rent, of being able to take care of your kids. We have tons of parents on tour. It's really anxiety producing. Yeah. And so I think if these players haven't been able to take a full break in the lead up to these events, then they're going to take it right now. I mean, even the Olympic teams are telling me, like, we have no idea. We don't even know if the Olympics is going to go off.
Yeah.
You know, so we can't really even make a set plan for that. So everything's just contingency planning right now. And like I said, there might be something with USA Volleyball for the top teams to be able to compete and do some training blocks in this fall down in the Hermosa area. They may try and put together their own little mini competitions as well. I don't know. Maybe if Brazil is going to host something, I mean, somewhere in the Southern Hemisphere, maybe they have competitions. Maybe they can
Costa
go down
to Brazil. One infection, I believe, or one fatality from COVID. Costa Rica, I'd be down with that.
That's what you say. Yeah. So, I mean, they really, really don't know. I mean, from the top teams to the grinders, they're just like, don't know what we're doing, you know? So it's family time. It's time to stay healthy. But maybe just get a little bit of a mental break.
Yeah. Well, hey, Jeff, I cannot thank you enough for taking these last 3 weeks to do the recaps and the previews for this AVP Champions Cup series. It's been an exciting time. And like I said, there are rising stars that came out from this, and you're definitely one of them on the Amazon Prime feed, because as a volley geek, I mean, I enjoy the breakdown, but I love hearing strategy and, you know, situational things that happen, mechanics, technique. I mean, it's all there. It's a great package. It's entertaining. And we even love the stories that you like to reference during your play calling. So it was a good time listening to you on court number 2, and looking forward to hearing you on some other broadcasts, streams, whatever, be it collegiate, professional, international. I hope that you're able to get some opportunities there.
I do too. I appreciate that. We got a ton of really positive feedback. I was asked to actually collect a large portion of it over the last 48 hours to send back into Amazon. They really wanted to actually hear, you know, from the horse's mouth, from the people that were watching, like, what did you like about it and what was good? And it seemed like people really did, as you mentioned, there was a space or a vacuum for some covers that really was true play-by-play with some color analysis. Somebody actually describing a little bit of the action and then asking the hows and the whys. And I was really, really thankful to be able to provide that. You know, I've done a lot of it in the past. Some of it's been formal, some has not been so formal, but you know, I think people do want to see that. It would have been really neat. We all talked about it when we got off the air at noon on Sunday, like, hey, if we do this again, we really want to try and get any sort of like graphics or replays or different camera angles where I could actually teach a little bit more. I think that's the one piece that I'd like to do, is explain with video a little bit more of what's going on. Right, we can all hear on audio what I'm saying, but if we could like picture some things the way they do, like NFL, some Telestrator, some slow motion replay to describe stuff, I think that there's going to be some interest for that too if we can pull it off. Yeah. But I appreciate your feedback, and everybody out there whose feedback helped get this thing going and allow Court 2 coverage like never before.
Well, in the times we're going through, it's exactly what we needed. So, again, this is Jeff Alzina, head coach of Santa Clara University Beach. He's the associate head coach of the indoor team, former Olympic coach, as well as, I know we heard it a ton of times, the winningest coach on the AVP. But honestly, I like calling you Volley Gandalf, and I love the new Snapchat filter that I was able to discover, the Jeff Alzina Snapchat filter. Check it out. Thanks for joining me again on the Viral Volley Podcast, Jeff.
My pleasure. Thanks, Rob. You're a treasure for our sport.
Thank you so much.